Hey guys, it's Anne. Welcome to Garage à Toi, episode 15. In this episode, I'm going to the archives to share an interview I did with my little brother Tom when he visited California back in March. While he was here, we went to a couple NCAA basketball games, so you're going to hear us talk about games that have already been lost and won. I also tricked him into singing Les Miserables, which I think is part of my duty as an older sister. So here's a little time capsule from March with my younger brother, Tom Halleck. It's Tom time.
What are we gonna talk about tonight? Whew. Can we talk about that wine?
Yeah, that needs to air out for sure.
Is it maybe not good?
It doesn't taste very good.
What I meant was, is it like expired?
I mean, red wine is not supposed to expire if it's...
Oh, good point.
If it's managed well.
Yeah.
But...
The cork seems like it's in fine shape. It's not like it was compromised.
Well, but it's not always just the cork. There's no foil over the cork.
Oh.
So, I mean, that's exposing to some stuff. And, I mean, we bought it out of a corner store.
Yeah, but it's a $22 bottle of wine.
I mean, even though it's nice, that doesn't mean that they treated it how it should be treated.
Yeah.
They could have just had it out in the back.
Sat in the sun.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, I don't think it's very good.
It does taste like somebody mixed rubbing alcohol
with wine?
Rotten juice.
The rotten juice.
Or they took the stuff off the bar mat and just dumped it.
No,
in
I'm not gonna be able to drink it. I could drink a lukewarm beer.
We could put that on ice too. That would be better. Lukewarm beer would be better.
Yeah, I feel like this is poisoning me.
I'm telling you, you know how you said that it was made in the funk zone?
Yeah.
I think it's called funk zone.
Like, it is. There's
no
the back of it.
Yeah, there's no late. Like, that's the brand.
I didn't realize that they literally made it. Like, in the gutter of the funk zone. We're going to get sued. We're going to be like Oprah with the Cattlemen's Association.
Funny part about the funk zone is that's what I call my armpits.
Okay, please tell me what you told me. Last night when we were at the game and the people were starting to yell at the referees.
Oh.
You said you heard the best referee insult you've ever heard. And so, like, common referee insults are like, Kate really loves, I'm blind, I'm deaf, I want to be a ref. She loves to chant that
she
at
does,
soccer games.
I heard that, yeah.
And then there, I remember, do you remember Jimmy Cantillon in high school? He was a year ahead of me.
That name
and
is a bell.
But... I remember him once at a football game saying, get off your knees, ref, you're blowing the game.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
That one's comes up all the time.
People like that one a lot.
Yeah.
Say the one that...
A friend of mine, I can't remember which friend it was right now, and they're going to kill me, but...
You have to do it in the accent.
Yeah, and that's... And so, she was telling me, I think
she was...
a
woman?
I think so.
Wow.
And she was saying, like, my dad or my grandpa used to say this.
Okay.
And he would say, I've seen better eyes on a potato.
I'm disappointed you didn't say potato.
Potato. I think it was more like potato, like... Potato.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to get, like, your regional accent correct.
I definitely don't have the right region of wherever it is in the South. I'm insulting someone for sure.
I was with Jocelyn and her husband, Sean, the other night, and Sean was relaying a story where he had met with someone, and they were telling him a really sad story that's a film idea, and the guy's reaction was, oh, so it's a comedy? And I was like, Sean, was that like a Birmingham accent? And he looks at me and he's like, it was. And I'm like, your fucking English regional accents are amazing.
Is it sad that I immediately thought you were talking about, you said Birmingham?
Oh, like Alabama.
Right. And I was like, that is not Birmingham, Alabama. That's far from it.
It's a comedy. I'm not even doing it. He like legitimately can do British accents.
I love it when you do accents.
You just get louder.
Yeah, I was going to say, you operate under the louder I talk, the more it's an accent.
That's good, too, if you're worried that someone is not understanding you.
So you're trying to speak in their accent?
No.
By yelling at
them?
I mean,
them? Like, in general. Like, if you think you're trying to explain something and someone isn't getting it, just get
talk
louder.
Talk louder.
Yep.
Totally.
Yep.
Totally.
Because, obviously, if they're not understanding you, they're just not listening. And
right.
If they're not listening, maybe it's because they can't hear you.
Mm-hmm. How do you sell a deaf guy a chicken?
Oh,
You say, "Hey, would you like to buy a chicken?"
What is that from?
That's from Brown that thing you do.
Oh.
Yeah. Shut up, I'll kick your ass.
For some reason, when people say that they're going to the dentist, I still say all day at the dentist, and no one, absolutely.
No one will get it.
Literally no one.
Oh, it's like a side note from a comedy. No. It's not like a joke.
That's like a, I don't, there's probably a term for that in Hollywood.
Oh.
For like the joke that you kind of like drop on the floor, and if anyone gets it, it's like a little hidden gem.
Yeah. Probably wouldn't be, not an Easter egg, that's more like if it's something
good.
More
like
overt,
an inside joke.
Yeah, but that's more overt, I think. I don't know.
Or not.
Or not.
Or it's hidden.
True.
Easter
good point.
Egg. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you first realized that you loved that thing you do, what part of it made you love it?
I think it started before I even saw it.
Oh, how?
Because we pre-ordered the VHS.
Are you kidding me?
From Sam Goody.
That doesn't sound like us.
Yeah, I know. That's why it was weird, is we were getting a new movie, which is way outside of our bounds.
Yeah.
Because we were poor.
I'm not fancy folk.
Yeah. Oh, we got It and Romeo and Juliet
with
Leo and Claire Danes at the same time. I don't know why we pre-ordered them at the same time. It was so weird.
Is it possible that it was one of those CD club, movie club type things where then we had to order stuff every month for the rest of our lives?
I could definitely see us getting roped into that.
Yeah.
However, we didn't get anything else after that. Mm-hmm. Those were like the only two movies that we pre-ordered. And so I just remember being like, this has to be amazing because we pre-ordered it. And I did love it. I mean, it's I love that type of like subtle, it's almost similar to like Flight of the Conchords where it's like a little slow and plotting. But like the jokes, if you get them, are like, they'll just like make you like cry laughing.
It's also a period piece.
Mm-hmm.
Featuring a young Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Maybe not young.
Not young. And isn't his wife in it, too? She plays like a...
The cocktail waitress.
Yeah, she has a little cameo.
At the blue spot.
Mm-hmm.
She says something gross to Dal.
Does she say something gross? I mean, she's just buddy-buddy with Dal and his friends.
And she's in, like, a Playboy Bunny costume, sort of.
Right,
like.
Yeah, she's
definitely... I remember
definitely,
being like, Rita!
She's pouring out of the dress, that's for sure.
Well, good for her. She's...
I mean, rock on.
She's a well-endowed woman.
Good for her.
Cheers
good
to
for,
you, Rita.
Good for Tom, too.
You're Tom?
Hanks, to be clear. good for Tom H.
I thought you were congratulating yourself for getting to see a lady's boobs pop out of your shirt.
Nailed it. Yeah, in that nice PG-13 movie.
I think Steve Zane is the hero of that film.
He's Lenny?
He is... Lenny.
Yeah. He is.
Yeah.
Keeping in mind, the bass player in that movie does not have a name in the movie.
His name is the bass player.
It's
like Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man. You don't realize until you maybe get to the end.
Okay, spoiler alert. he's absolutely the hero, because doesn't he? He gets the girl, and
oh,
he runs
yeah.
off. Yeah.
She says, "How long have you been wearing such tight pants?" And he says, that's a pickup line.
Yeah. We're a match made in
heaven.
Yeah.
And then the other part that I always think of when I'm around someone who's being obnoxious is I always think to myself, can somebody get Fabian away from me?
That guy has a mouthful of sandwich when he says that line, too.
It's
so.
Like a rumen. He's like, yeah. like pastrami
yeah.
on rye.
Like a sloppy pastrami.
There's also a lot about that film that I feel like is a reference to the time period, and I just don't get it.
Yeah.
But then Dad lately is really into, like, reading the newspaper out loud. And it's really awkward because the headlines are literally at least 12 hours old. Maybe 6 hours. Whenever they're printing it. They're printing the newspaper overnight. And so Dad will, you know, open the newspaper and want to read out loud to me, you know, the latest crazy thing that Trump did or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I know that happened yesterday.
Right.
I've already received that information.
And there's two other things
on top
of it.
I'm here from the future to tell you it's not getting any better. And it makes me think of the dad who sits there and is reading the ads, and he's like, oh, they say that they're open on Saturdays now. I don't think I want to live in a world, or is it Sundays?
It's Sundays, yeah.
They're open on Sundays now. I don't think I want to live in a world where you have to be open on Sunday, Mother.
To do business. Why don't we just get rid of this? Yeah.
So basically that movie is like my life.
It's your life now. Your life is now a period.
Oh, now.
Piece.
It's my life now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're living in a period piece.
Okay, so we went to the game last night. Do you want to give me some perspectives on how you felt like the game went?
Yeah. I would say it's becoming... This is probably something that people who watch March Madness with a keener eye notice, but I would say that the teams with more energy won. It wasn't like there was a team that was clear-cut better. Like, the teams that were playing harder, it was very obvious.
It was very obvious.
Yeah. I mean, we saw the Florida State Gonzaga game. Gonzaga.
No, it's Gonzaga.
Is it Gonzaga? But, I mean, English doesn't follow any rules like that. I mean,
It was people last night. We're not following any rules. I'm just saying it's Gonzaga.
Yeah.
If you're going to say zag the way that they say it.
Got it.
It's sort of like when we campaigned for Senator Obama in Nevada. And they had to tell us before we went knocked door to door. It's not Nevada. It's Nevada. And I'm like, right, but it is Nevada.
Right.
So say it correctly, please.
In Spanish, right?
Yeah. Although you live in Texas, you deal with that every day.
Oh, man. Yeah, they couldn't. Yeah, it's more appropriate to just completely mispronounce things.
When in doubt.
Yeah. Just
pronounce the hard A.
Yeah. Or add a hard A at your leisure.
Okay, so last night, you felt like the teams with the higher energy triumphed. I think that's absolutely right. What do you think happened with Texas A&M? I really felt like they didn't show up.
They didn't. And I didn't watch them closely. I'm not super into college basketball. From what I've heard, they were supposed to be feeding their bigs. They were supposed to be, you know, getting down and making it a slower game.
Yeah.
And they just had no control over the game. And that's because it seemed like Michigan was just running it. They were trying harder. They were jumping for stuff. They were going for it. And that's what ended up doing it. There's two things that might be true all the time in March and in the NCAA tourney. But it also may be a function of this year. I heard that there were no teams that were head and shoulders above anybody else.
Really?
So maybe it really is just this year that's true, and maybe more often a Kentucky will have five guys that are better and they don't need energy and they're just that much better.
Or they won't.
Right.
R.I.P. Kentucky.
I know.
Sorry, bros.
Sorry, lass.
Shouldn't have worn those ugly uniforms.
You don't like the checks?
I don't like the checks. I'm like, please just don't do this. Just, I mean, it wasn't play basketball. Stop wearing checkered
but
pants.
That's kind of their thing. I mean, think about it. Kentucky Derby, right? Don't they have a checkered flag or something? Close enough.
Tom, riddle me this. Who competes in the Kentucky Derby?
Yeah. Is it the Kentucky Wildcats?
Yep.
Nailed it.
You got it, buddy.
Championship.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the checkered flag is some nod to the Kentucky heritage. I get it. I don't like it. Just wear a normal uniform.
But that's the thing, is they have to have some little flair.
And then they lost.
True.
Yeah. I mean,
remember when Baylor would wear their highlighter colored uniforms? Everybody wants to have their little niche.
I don't remember that. I was just thinking of University of Oregon and all the ugly shit they wear. They've been humbled, though. They've gotten knocked off their high horse.
But I think they're still going to go out and wear the weirdest, funkiest stuff because they have that. They have so much money.
Nike's begging them to.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. Well, I also thought with the Florida State game, I mean, we had at least one 5-second call along the baseline. They were, like, really pressing.
Yeah.
Which I love because I'm also not a huge basketball fan. I didn't grow up watching it. I did stats for the boys' basketball team my senior year of high school. I think I did that instead of PE or something. And it's not a game where I feel super confident when you know, like if they make a call or something like that. If I'm watching soccer and the ref makes a call I think is bad, I'm out of my seat, I'm screaming at him. Mm-hmm. You know, I can yell what I think really happened. And in basketball, I just don't feel that way. I don't feel super confident with, like, the technicalities of it.
And you and I talked about that at the game, yeah, where there was so much contact.
Yeah.
Like, if you just watch the centers alone,
yeah,
they are shoving, pushing, like, getting their arms tangled the entire time. And then a whistle will blow out of nowhere when somebody's wrist gets tapped, where it's, like, there's... The lines are very blurred on what's a foul.
Well, and I don't love the game of basketball because I hate the fouling strategy that you use at the end of the game.
Ugh.
Okay. I was asking Mom and Dad this question. Can you think of any other sport where as a consequence for a foul, you get an uninterrupted shot on the goal? Any other sport?
Uninterrupted?
They got to shoot like a free throw.
Where
no one's in their way.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, is every like, with soccer, it's not that no one's in the way, but you get 10 yards. So, I mean, it's sort of similar, I would say. Like, everybody has to stand back for you to, like, get your kick.
Except, let's just use the analogy of taking a shot inside the box.
Mm-hmm.
The keeper's in the box. There's no scenario where you get to kick the ball toward an open goal.
Maybe that should be a thing in soccer.
I'm into that.
You get a penalty, you get to choose to kick it with 10 yards from where it is, or you have to kick it from your own 18-yard box.
Oh!
And nobody can defend it until after you kick it. So, like, everybody has to stand at half line, and you can kick it past them, and people can run after it, but nobody can stand in the goal. Huh?
No, I don't like that.
I love it.
Yeah, no.
Making it a thing.
Make up your own game. What are you going to call that? What's that game called? Idiot ball.
Yeah.
Idiot ball. You're not supposed to agree with me. I was insulting you.
Yeah, idiot ball. That's good.
You're an idiot.
Siri, make a note.
No, it was fun, though. We saw those famous twins.
Yeah. Well, famous is a strong word.
Famous is a strong word.
They have...
Rich. We saw those rich twins.
I mean, that might be strong, too. Mm-hmm. I guess they live in L.A., so...
We saw those TV celebrities.
There you go.
My favorite part was they were standing up waving to someone, and I was pointing them out to you. And then, like, 10 minutes later, we realized that you were looking, like, two rows ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was looking somebody... Different, completely different look, different race even. It was just all
but
different.
Twins.
Yes.
Maybe famous?
I think so.
Yeah.
But I didn't get a good enough look, so.
No. We also, you're holding glasses in your hand right now, so I also feel like you couldn't have seen them if you wanted to.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. So I have a question for you about college basketball. Florida State.
Are you going to test me right now?
Not a test, a general question.
Technical.
And this is something coming from, I mean, maybe this is happening more than I'm giving it credit for.
Oh, I feel like I know what you're going to ask me right now.
Oh, okay. Florida State seemed to have a lot of international players.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about them rolling their shorts up.
Oh, the rolling shorts. That'll be next.
Okay, good.
But they had a lot of international players.
Yes.
I felt like, I think another team, it might be Purdue, has like some international players. That seems to be a growing trend.
For college. Yeah.
Which is odd, because, I mean, obviously that's true in the NBA, because it's the best league in the world. But, what are your thoughts on that growing in the NCAA?
Well, I was actually thinking about, so the guy who we noticed, I just forgot his last name. Rui.
Hachimura. Yeah, you got it.
And I noticed when they were calling the teams out that there's a player who I believe they said was from Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that stupid moment where I'm like, do they mean the school or the country?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, no, we're at a college game. They did not mean Columbia University. But I remember even going to a UCLA tennis game a couple years ago, and almost the entire team were from other countries.
Oh, okay.
So I think there is a precedent for college to have students coming in from other countries. I think what surprises us is we think of basketball as being a fairly American sport. At least I do. You know, I think tennis is played, you know, around the world. Is basketball? I actually don't know.
It's funny that you bring this up, because that's what I was thinking about, is when the Dream Team played in, 92?
Yep.
they said that that did more for the globalization of basketball than anything else.
God.
And so, like, there are a ton of international players now, but that's because they all saw the Dream Team play in 92 and were so enthralled with them and just, you know,
but Tom, they
intrigued
didn't
by basketball.
Because how old would they have been in 92 if they're in college right now?
Well, that's the thing is...
Zero. They were not born.
That would mean if you were in 92, if you were 6 years old...
Yeah.
Then that would mean that, you know, like the globalization of basketball would be starting to peak in the early thousands.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what you're talking about.
Yeah. I was teasing. I mean, I
think... Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
That's right, teasing. No, I think you're right, because you look at... Let's just use soccer as the opposite example.
Yeah.
Which is, soccer is in the DNA of so many different countries around the world.
Totally.
And it was only fairly recently popular in the U.S. in the way that it is. And I remember watching a documentary about soccer in Denmark, and how these kids basically... from the moment that they're born, are playing soccer.
Yeah.
And they go to camps in the summer, and they live away from their families.
Yeah,
and everyone's
like boarding schools for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I always think of soccer as, like, truly an international sport where, yes, the U.S. participates, but we didn't even qualify for the World Cup. You know, it's that kind of stuff where I think we have this very easy idea of, like, Americans are great at sports. And it's like, okay, well, sports that you've been raised around, maybe, and sports that are not as popular in other countries. You know, American football. You have to say American football because there's a whole other sport called football. But yeah, they had a very high number. The center, who's 7'4",
yeah,
was from...
Chad, wasn't
Chad.
He?
Chad.
Mm-hmm.
They had another guy from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
They had that guy who looked like he woke up... He was like a child wearing adult clothing. He was like Tom Hanks and Big. He was from America. I'm just making fun of him.
Oh, okay.
He looked like an idiot in his roster photo.
Yeah, he did not look good.
But they just came to play. That team came to play.
They definitely, yeah, they had more energy. They were more passionate. They were ready.
But they were also, every time that Gonzaga had to inbound the ball, they were slapping it out of their hands.
Yeah.
You know, it was like they were playing a full press the whole game.
Well, that's, there was a Malcolm Gladwell, I think it was Malcolm Gladwell book about that, where it's like, yeah, go for it. Go all the way in. People won't be able to react to it.
Yeah, because there's like some sort of etiquette for the game
mm-hmm.
that lets you inbound the ball and take it to the half court before you start pressing people. And in that story... I wonder if it was probably Outliers, if I had to guess. Have
yes,
you read David
I'm
and
sure.
Goliath?
Okay. Yeah.
Or
no, it was David and Goliath.
Was it?
Yeah, it was.
Okay. David and Goliath, I felt like, was sort of the leftovers from Outliers. Honestly. So I have like a very hard time when I try to remember. I'm like, could have been either one.
Yeah, they're both so similar.
It was basically who made like the A team and who made the B team. Malcolm, get your shit together. I'm tired of you recycling the boring content.
And yet we've read both.
I know. I think I have read all of his books, actually.
It's interesting content. It's good to look at stuff with a new eye or a new angle.
My favorite of his books is What the Dog Saw. And it's a collection of his essays that he wrote for The New Yorker.
Hmm.
And what I love about them is that in his later books, I really do feel like he gets a little bit lazier about having a thesis that he defends
mm-hmm.
with research. I feel like it just sort of is like, cool fact, cool fact, cool fact. I've got a lot of money. I don't have time for this.
Yeah.
Spumoni. And what I love about the collection of essays is that every single essay is very tight, very well researched, super tight thesis. Very clear what he's trying to achieve and telling you the story, and then it's over. Every chapter is a different story.
Do you think that's a function of the avenue that he's delivering it, though, where it's like it needs to be, and if it's an essay, that needs to be under 1,000 or 2,000, whatever it is, words.
Right. Yes, but I also think, and I've noticed this with other authors, their first book is their like masterwork.
Right.
You know, they always say, with novels, your first novel is always your best because it's the one you spent your whole life writing.
True.
And then your second one is just going to be like, what, it took you 5 years? That's cute.
Or Cutting Room Floor or whatever it is.
That's the problem. Yeah. That's where I get frustrated, is I start to feel like, you know who's done this who I love, and I literally have not bought her last two books. Anne Lamott, who's mm-hmm. super inspiring, writes very compellingly. She wrote a book called Operating Instructions, which was her journey as a single pregnant woman after getting sober. So she was in her early 30s, was in a committed relationship, got pregnant, and the guy broke up with her, and she decided to keep the baby. Oh. And it's this book of basically journal entries where she talks about, like, dear baby, I feel terrible today, I'm super lonely, I want to have a drink. You know, just, like, she's super honest. And that book was really moving for me because it was the first time that anyone really talked about self-love. That's not true. People have talked about it forever and ever. It was the first time I ever read about self-love. And this idea that when you're going through a hard time, instead of blaming yourself and feeling bad about yourself, you go the opposite way and you say, oh, you're having such a hard time right now. Poor little baby. And this idea of really meeting yourself with compassion, whereas I think a lot of people, our inclination is to be very hard on ourselves.
That does feel like a more genuine approach to self-love as opposed to, like, here's step one to self-love.
Right.
Like,
right. And so it's this very personal journal. It's literally a journal. And so it's her being funny. She'd been an essayist for a long time, but it was really, I believe it's her first actual book. And it would have been very easy for something like that to feel kind of half-assed. Oh, great, you published your journal. Thanks a lot. And instead, it's the opposite. It's very moving. It really changed my life. I recommend that book to people all of the time.
It's called Operating Instructions.
Operating Instructions. And her son is now an adult and has a kid, and he's a writer, and he just went through a really painful breakup, and he blogged about it the whole time. But her subsequent books really felt like a ripoff of a ripoff of a ripoff of a ripoff, where it was just sort of like, by the end, I mean, literally the pages are smaller, the type is bigger. And I just was like, what are you doing? If you didn't have enough to actually write a book, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah. But then that makes me start thinking, like, the pressure is coming from somewhere else.
Her publisher, probably.
Totally. And that's, I mean... And if you have something that was so genuine and so meaningful to you personally, and then they're like, hey, do that again because we're going to pay you all this money for it, you're kind of like, wow.
Remember that time you ripped your guts out?
Yeah.
Do that again.
It's funny because I was talking with someone else about this where, like, the tortured artist is such an important perception where it doesn't even have to be the reality. I mean, the artist could be living a posh lifestyle, but as long as you have the impression that they are suffering to deliver their art, it makes it so much more meaningful. It was actually, it's funny, it was a musician, and he had gone on The Voice. His name's Nakia. He's actually incredible. Really well-spoken guy, like, just knows the industry from top to bottom. He gave a talk to a group that I was at. But he was saying that it's sometimes, like, I mean, he was on The Voice. He was on Team CeeLo. Like, he was, I mean, he's an incredible artist. And he's had all this popularity because he's obviously pretty good.
Yeah.
But he said coming back to Austin and trying to book gigs, sometimes that's used against you.
Oh.
Where it's like,
you're commercial. You're too
commercial. Yeah, like, you're commercial now. We don't want you in our, like, in our artist space. You know, where it's like, just because you're not publicly suffering or the other way around. Because you're publicly successful or whatever it is, that you can't be tortured like it's like somebody else, or like you can't be grungy like somebody else. And it's just,
how do you react to that?
That's the thing, is I get that. Like, as a consumer, I totally see that, where I think a band that you and I both relate to, the 88, they went through something that was kind of weird, where it was like they got super corporate super quick.
Yeah.
And I think that they were an incredible band and probably still are, but it hurt their image right away, where it was like, I don't even know if they're still making albums.
It's like you heard their song during One Tree Hill on the CW, and you're like, fuck those.
You're like, and I'm gone, and I'm done.
Sellouts.
Well, and it's hard, because I think as an artist, like, obviously you want to take something that's going to pay you the most, because you want to be successful, that's success. But then, like, this band Little Hurricane, who Caitlin and I like, they were on a Taco Bell commercial.
Oh,
and so it's like,
how you heard about them or no?
No, Caitlin had known about them for a long time.
Okay.
And so now we're at the point where it's, they were on
know them before they were cool.
Like, they're like, oh, is that the, if you tell people about them, like, we're going
Bell
to see
band?
Them. Yeah, they say, is it the Taco Bell band? It's like, that's not even close to who they are, but, I mean, they took an opportunity,
What's
I'm assuming.
The Taco Bell commercial song?
Well, it's funny because I think the song is called Give 'Em Hell.
Okay.
And so it's just like a couple clips from that. I don't think they actually say the word hell, but...
Oh, funny. Are you not going to sing it is what you're telling me?
I don't even know if I know what part is in the commercial. It's like, give 'em hell, give 'em hell. I don't even know
if it's... That sounds familiar. Although that sounds like something that would be in like a Ford F-150 ad.
Yeah, but it's that...
Like it's, a rock.
It's like the Taco Bell Cantina type ad.
Sin and Arrow Street. Who's that? That's Chevy? That's Toyota. Like a rock.
No, it's Chevy, I think.
Right. I said Ford. Tom, have some more space juice.
Yeah, this stuff is...
It's not good, and yet I continue to drink it.
I mean, it's... I guess it's not that bad.
I feel like I need to explain how you humiliated us in front of the 88, and yet I feel like I can't explain it.
Yeah, I don't know if that would translate to spoken word.
No.
It really needs some...
You need some, like, priceless artwork and a rope that you're not supposed to stand behind.
And then I think
I need you to stand behind it as a band comes to perform in front of...
But they were just coming out to, like, meet and greet, and I happened to jump in front of them to tell them to look out for the cord that I was accidentally standing behind next to the priceless artwork.
So you were like, why don't I get in front of these musicians who just performed for us, and then once I've alerted them to the danger, I'm then going to step on the other side of a rope that is meant to keep me away from the art.
I mean, we're missing the headliner here, which is priceless piece of artwork saved by local man.
That's good.
That's the headliner.
That's good.
Also,
that's actually what security said when they walked
right,
us out.
Yeah. Man terrifies band by jumping out a la Zoolander when he's in the coal mine with his brothers and dad.
They're like, local hero escorted out by security.
Yes. See? Phrasing is important about
phrasing
these things.
Phrasing is important.
Yeah.
That is true. You're welcome, the 88, for not having injured yourself. I have to say, though, it is a little weird to me that there would be a rope, but there wasn't a rope coming off the wall. It was only in front of the wall.
It was, yeah.
We can post a diagram on the show notes so that people really appreciate. Oh, you know what we'll do? Let's do a reenactment.
Ooh, okay.
Okay. I don't know who we're going to get.
See, this is the stuff, if Vine still existed, this is what Vine was for.
We need a Vine of you blocking, physically blocking the forward progress of a band called the 88.
I mean, sacrificing my physical well-being to save priceless art and save the band from humiliating
themselves.
You basically
took a bullet for them.
I mean, they looked cool after that.
You were
because
like...
Because I looked like such a weirdo.
That's right.
So
you were like Kevin Costner in The Bodyguard.
Yeah. Well,
Spoiler alert.
Did he look like a weirdo or did he just get shot?
He took a bullet.
He literally took a bullet.
Actually, I don't remember. No, he took a bullet. I feel like
he probably took a bullet.
We, Jocelyn, Sean, and I, and some other friends of theirs, went and saw The Bodyguard at the Pantages. It was a musical. Tom, I was with you when we saw Cats.
Oh, yeah.
Give me on a scale of 1 to 10, how meowvelous was that?
Cats?
Cats.
Meowvelous meaning... Like
you can just whatever that means to you, scale 1 to 10.
Would use claws to rip my eyes out. That is like a 9.5.
Yeah, like 9 lives.
Yes.
Plus, was your knee hurt? I know I
had strained my supra patella running in college, and it was still swelling. It was still at the point where I like couldn't really treat it, and I remember rocking back and forth in my chair and just being like, I don't know if I can make it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I can do this.
What if it killed you?
Like from shock or stress,
yes.
Like my heart almost stopped beating because I was so like just freaking out about how horrible the entire experience
was.
It was really, really bad.
It was so bad. I remember just everyone kept being like, it's the longest running musical in the history of musicals. And I'm like, this is a con that like people have bought into at an alarming rate. This is like a global conspiracy.
Emperor's New Clothes for sure. I mean,
it was so bad. And I like Andrew Lloyd Webber. I'm not an Andrew Lloyd Webber snob. I saw The Phantom of the Opera when I was maybe like 10 or 11, and it continues to be one of my favorite musicals.
So good.
Yeah.
Did Andrew Lloyd Webber do A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder? Am I misremembering that?
I've never heard of that play.
So
you're going to have to look it up. But I'm going to look up.
I will look it up.
Who wrote Les Mis?
Oh.
Do you know?
I should know.
I, on the way to work this morning, started thinking of the line, and I'm old and will be gone. Can you sing it for me? And I am old
and will be gone.
What is that from?
That's from Les Mis. That's towards the end.
What's the song, though?
Bring Him Home. Bring him home. He is young.
Yeah.
He's afraid.
Let him rest.
Yeah, I'm messing up the words. Yeah, that one.
Oh, man. So I saw it in London a couple months ago, and I literally was in the second to last row. Got in a fight with a gentleman behind me because his knee was in my head, and he said, I'm too tall for the seat. And I said, clearly you're the tallest person in the theater, so you're the only one having that problem. And he said, you're a real cheeky wench, aren't you? And I laughed out loud because I didn't realize people use those words.
I don't think they do.
Yeah. I'm like, you called me a wench right before we watched Les Mis. I was like, am I Fantine?
Victor Hugo, by the way, wrote Les Mis.
No. The music. Victor Hugo wrote the novel that Les Miserables is based on.
Oh.
Yeah.
The music?
The music. Who is the librettist?
Yeah, what's the...
Just say music by Les Miserables.
Claude Michael Schoenberg?
Oh, Schoenberg. I've heard of him.
Oh, okay, yeah. One of my faves.
And I saw, I was by myself. I'd been traveling by myself for a little bit.
When was this again?
It would have been end of September, beginning of October, maybe.
Okay.
I was in London.
Oh,
right. It was
right
before I went to Morocco. And I got just like a last minute ticket, literally got like the cheapest ticket I could find. So I was in the second to last row in the balcony. And Javert started singing Stars.
Mm.
Can you sing that?
One of my faves.
Sing it a little bit.
Stars in their multitudes, scarce to be counted. And then I don't know what he says right
there. I know,
I changing
the
to order and light. You
I'm
are
at
the
it.
Sentinels. Robert Friedman wrote A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
So a nobody. Sorry, Robert Friedman's family, but it's true.
We can talk about A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder if you want to talk about that.
No, I think you want to talk about that.
It was better than I thought it was going to be. It's not a traditional play.
It was no cats, is what you're
saying.
It
was
me?
No cats. I had very, very low expectations because I tried to listen to it on Spotify before I went.
Can you explain how you ended up going to a play by yourself in your hometown called
A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder?
Explain yourself.
Well, so I am a season subscriber.
Why?
Because you had to be a subscriber this season in order to be a subscriber for the following one, because Hamilton is coming.
Oh, those sneaky fuckers. Do you think the people who run that play series were like, we got him?
I think if you look at next season's lineup, the one where they have Hamilton coming in, you can absolutely tell that they completely shot their wad on Hamilton. The other...
Is it like local theater productions of Hamlet?
It is worse. The other things in that season, I think Cats is in it, which, I mean, right there alone, I'm almost like...
Red flag.
I want to like burn the tickets in front of them. Like,
you should go protest.
Pretend like I'm walking in and then burn the tickets in front of them and just walk away.
Tom, let's go in, sit through like 7 minutes of it, and then have some sort of a banner that we unfurl that is like... We should reenact
like
the
we get tased.
From Family Guy.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, God.
I'm so sorry. It came out of nowhere.
Okay, so you had a buy-in in 2018
right.
in order to get tickets for Hamilton 2019.
Correct.
Wait for it.
Yeah, and I'm definitely waiting for it, because also in the next season is the sequel to Phantom of the Opera. Not a thing. Which, by the way, the picture that goes along with it is a bedazzled phantom mask. Not a thing. It's not a thing.
Maybe it's him, like, when he's younger?
Why would he have a bedazzled mask? It's, like, and then there's, I don't like, what, well, not that I don't like, I think it's low, to have a play reference itself, and so there's a play that is also next season called The Play That Goes Wrong.
Oh, yeah.
It may be incredible. I don't know. But I hate that it references itself.
It breaks the fourth wall.
I hate that.
Yeah.
But Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
And it was fun. It was cute.
Where it was like, I thought it was actually really well done.
Huh.
So, like, I saw School of Rock alone also.
Okay. I admire you.
That was fun. It was not good. The dialogue was not good. The acting was not good. But the kids playing the instruments was really...
You said that one kid was, like, shredding.
Incredible. They were truly incredible musicians. But it wasn't good. It was fun. And so it's funny because Jaws and I used to have this argument about movies where we, like...
Let me guess which side he ended up on.
But, no, he would say, like, you go to see a movie like Inception.
Yeah.
And you walk out and you're like, wow, that was so good. And he's like, no, it wasn't good. It was entertaining, which is different. And I, at the time, I was like, you're being a jerk. Like, you're being a jackass, basically.
Yeah, you're being a snob.
Totally. But the more you think about it, it's kind of true where it's like, was that good or was that a fun 2 hours?
People love to hate on that movie. BJ Novak gave an interview. He's Ryan on The Office.
Yeah.
He does a ton of writing and stuff. And he gave an interview where he, like, specifically called out Inception and was like, well, did you, you know, I don't really love Christopher Nolan's work. Did you really enjoy yourself while you were watching that film? And I'm like, yeah, I did. It was super fucking cool. The idea that you could, like, go into someone's dream state and that time has slowed down and there's all these new rules that you're engaging with. I thought that was a really cool movie.
It's cool. It's fun. It's entertaining. That doesn't mean that it's good. Like, he's right. If you break down the concept, it's stupid. Like, are you kidding me?
Is it stupider than any other movie?
Correct. But that's the thing is, like...
Is it stupider than That Thing You Do? Answer carefully.
It's absolutely stupider than That Thing You Do, because That Thing You Do is incredible. But I feel like there is a little bit of a line there, and it does get into snobbery to draw that line, to make a point to draw that line.
Right.
But there are times where it's important, where it's like, School of Rock is the example for me, where it's like, I had fun, and I would totally recommend it to people.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that was the best theater I've ever seen.
Got it.
Yeah.
Whereas, I'm telling you right now, Hamilton is the best play you are ever going to see in your life.
And you're saying that... I mean, I obviously listen to the songs all the time. I know the majority of the
words.
Which
is so funny to me. I can't, when I saw it, I'd never heard the soundtrack.
Yeah.
So it's crazy to me to think that you would know the plot, basically.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you know the plot?
Yeah. I mean, well, the other part of it is it's American history as well. But yeah, I mean, and I've listened to the soundtrack all the way through, and then I just shuffle it now, but like...
You shuffle it? That's interesting. Yeah.
But tell me why you say that it's the best that you'll see.
So I wanted to write something about it right after I saw it, and I just didn't, because I didn't feel like I had a medium to write it. And I don't know why I felt like I had to publish it somewhere. So I could have just written a Word document and saved it somewhere and really captured how I felt in the moment that I saw it. But the two words that I think of the most often... when I think about what it was like to sit in the theater and have the experience of having someone create something so compelling is the true literal sense of the word inspiration, and this idea that it has to do with breath, that it has to do with breathing in, and the fact that Lynn had so many different cultural touch points that he was referring to when he wrote it, not just historical America and the founding of the country, but hip-hop, pop culture, so many different things. And to have witnessed someone's synthesis of all of that information, I remember the night that I saw it, having the sense of, like, he had sort of, like, sucked everything in. Do you remember that story when we were little about the boy who sucks in the ocean?
No,
that grandma used to tell us.
No, but keep going.
He sucks in the ocean, and everyone runs out, and they are, like, picking up the fish. And it's kind of a weird, gross story, because then the kid, like, can't hold it for long, so he spits it back out, and everybody drowns.
You know, oh, story? Okay.
Yeah, good story. Wow. The sense of Lynn as a kid in the, you know, late 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, had absorbed everything that made him him. His Puerto Rican-ness, the fact that he's a person of color living in the northeastern United States, that he loves hip-hop, that he's, a musical nerd, had, like, and then what came out was this just roar of thoughtfulness and art that he has people in his life who he had worked with on his previous plays, like In the Heights.
Yeah.
He worked with Chris Jackson on In the Heights, and then, you know, Chris Jackson was going to be his Washington. And they always quote, it's an Aaron Sorkin line where he says, as long as I've got a job, you've got a job. And this idea that, like, in some ways, Chris Jackson is kind of his muse.
Yeah.
And that he's, like, you know, the sense of who he had as Washington. And, he, you know, that whole section where he's, like, embellishing my elegance. And, like, he starts telling a story, like, can I be real for a second? Like, you know, what does he say? Break it down and tell you how I feel for a second?
Yeah.
I'm the model of a modern major general. And it's, like, he wasn't just talking about Washington. He was talking about Christopher Jackson.
Yeah.
And that was something that could have only been written because of his relationship with Chris Jackson, because he wrote about him in The Heights. And I look at that and I'm like, holy fucking shit. We saw art get made. If you want to look back and say, like, what inspired Mozart? And when we listen to his music today, people were in the room for the things that he was inspired by, that he wrote in. And I just think we are at a moment in our lives, a year from now, you're going to sit in a theater and you're going to have an experience where you're going to notice there's, like, Biggie Smalls references.
Yeah.
He refers to KRS-One.
Mm-hmm.
He sings, you know, pop songs. I hated when they said, like, the Skylar Sisters are, like, Destiny's Child. I'm like, that's annoying. That's a lazy comparison.
That's super lazy.
You're just looking for, like, three women of color. That's
right.
So lazy.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
There's so much more than that. And
yeah.
There's this Ham for Ham where the guys who played, the different actors who played King George, come out and do a lip sync of the Skylar Sisters. That's fucking part of it. That's part of the art, is that Lynn was like, I'm writing the soundtrack for Moana right now. I have a little kid at home. I'm playing Hamilton 7 times a week. We're going to, every Wednesday, come out and do some cheesy little thing to give you all the chance to get tickets to go to the show.
Yeah.
And those pieces that were recorded, you know, we can play the mashup that they do. They did it during the Snowmageddon, the blizzard.
Yeah.
Where they actually had to cancel a couple shows. And the Ham for Ham that they did was a mashup of Leslie Odom Jr. singing Wait For It.
Oh my God.
And him singing Stars.
Wow.
And he, you know, whoever it is who's in the room is playing just on, like, a keyboard, and the sound is really terrible. And every time I watch it, I cry.
Yeah.
Because it's fucking art. Like, yeah. they're creating some relationship between what they wrote and, in this example, Les Mis. And they're doing it so skillfully.
Not just creating, either. It's weaving so many things together. And I feel like that's the crazy part to me about Hamilton, is he's taking all the, like, hip-hop, his experience, like, being whatever it might be, and marginalized in some way, and he's pulling it into this red-blooded American story. You know, like, this is the roots of America.
Yeah.
And it's, like, that's how it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be woven together.
Right.
Like, and it is funny because I feel like so many parts of it are like, and I remember reading an interview that he gave in, I think it was Rolling Stone, like right when it was getting big.
Yeah.
And like, he's like, he was talking about Trump at the time, but he was like, this is not new. Like everything, nothing's really new anymore.
Yeah.
Like it's a, you know, regeneration of what's happened before.
Yeah.
And so for him to be able to like so skillfully weave that and make something new and make something so poignant in the time, but also referencing history, referencing his history.
Yeah.
It's just so cool. And well, when Stephen Hawking died, it wasn't until after I heard that he died where I was like, how cool that we were alive at the same time as him.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to be more cognizant of that, of being the same way with Lynn. Yeah, yeah. And the same thing, I did the same thing, and I should just pay more attention. Did the same thing with David Bowie and Prince and Michael Jackson and just so many artists where it's like so many of these creators doing these such cool things. And that's, I mean, that's obviously very salient people. There's so many other geniuses doing so many cool things that aren't getting that type of press. But I'm just trying to be more aware of, like...
I love that.
Yeah.
Contemporary art leaders.
Well, just leaders in general, because I feel like we do live in an age where stupid people are famous. Like, it's so much easier to be... If you are as dumb as you can be, you will be famous. And I don't even want to use people's names, but... Lonzo Ball's father, I'm not even going to say his name, but like he has chosen, he knows that he can be famous and he can actually bring success to his family by being as, not abhorrent, that's an overstatement, but like, he's just, he's like, he's a blowhard. I mean, that's all he is. And I feel like it's a lot of the leaders in our country right now too.
He's like an awful stage mom.
Really? And that's the thing is, but he knows that it works.
Yeah.
And he's like, he, to make a weird comparison, like, it's the Jenna Maroney of life, where it's like, I'm going to do this for the attention, and I know I'm doing it for the attention, but you're like, I'm not going to admit that.
Well, she's publicly. A satirical character. She's a crazy person,
and we're in so many ways. We live satire, satire is playing itself out every day. But it's just, it's cool to acknowledge the people who are doing real things that are incredible.
Well, Lynn is someone too, where he's such a positive force in the world. He's such an amazing philanthropist from the standpoint of, you know, he's going to get all these artists together to do a song to raise awareness for the devastation that happened in Puerto Rico. And, you know, his persona on Facebook and on Twitter, he's just constantly so positive. And he went through a very difficult, very dark time of writing that musical. It wasn't easy, you know, and I look at...
But, is that a tortured artist? Huh?
Oh!
Does that make it more genuine?
Interesting, Tom.
But sorry, I interrupted, sorry.
Now, that's funny to think about. Yeah. We do love our tortured geniuses, and he is truly a genius. He can't sing worth shit. I hate hearing him sing. You and I watch Moana.
I was talking about this, was it with you or someone else? I don't remember. But we were saying, like, his voice is not good.
No.
Objectively.
No.
But now it's recognizable to the point that it is good, where it's like, oh.
It's its own brand.
Yeah, it's a brand, and even though it's absurd that, like, you would put him amongst some of the best artists in the world, or best singers in the world, it's... Now it's not. At first, like, that's so ridiculous, but...
So I have to tell you, the one thing that I'm jealous of you getting to see Hamilton in 2019, is that it's very likely that you're going to see someone who has a classically trained Broadway voice. You're going to hear that music in a way that I have never heard it. I saw him live, and I hear him on the soundtrack. The Hamilton who I hear is flat... And not tone deaf, but very, very flat.
And, yeah.
You're going to hear an amazing singer sing those words and sing that music. I didn't have that experience. You're having a totally different experience than I have.
Yeah. Well, the weird part to me, too, is I've only ever lived through the soundtrack. The idea that they're going to be acting on stage and it's going to be different voices than I've heard for the 1,000 times I've listened to it. It's going to be a different experience for me, too. Like, it's going to be a totally different... I don't even know.
The first time that I heard the soundtrack, I actually didn't like it because the musical was so dynamic and was so... It felt so real that when I heard the soundtrack and everyone's on beat and they're all kind of singing, you know, at the same time, and it was like, ew, this is boring. This is gross. This is really boring. This is, like, one-dimensional. And now I listen to it, and it's just, you know, it's what I know.
Yeah.
And so I actually think what's going to be hard for you is in your mind, you're going to be, like, keeping the beat.
Yeah.
And they're going to be dancing, and they're going to be off by one measure, and you're going to be like, ah, like, what is this?
What are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm going to be shouting along with them.
I actually wonder if that's a problem that they have with people coming in and actually knowing the music.
Do they, I would assume when they got really popular, they had to be like, we
don't
all
want
to sing along. Yeah. Like, we understand that this is a phenomenon, but like
Mike Pence, please don't sing along.
Mike Pence, please sit down during
Mike Pence, please stop crying loudly. I mean, you are, I just want to prepare you, like, you're gonna cry your face off.
I'm ready.
Can I show you what I'm proudest of?
I know, some of those lyrics, they're hard to even get out.
Oh my god.
Singing alone.
I was at a conference in the fall, and I was talking to this woman about the play, and she'd never seen it. And I didn't say that I had, we were just talking about it. And she said, oh, and I always cry. And I look at her, and I'm like, me too. And she looks at me, and she goes, The Orphanage. And I literally, like, welled up with tears. The Orphanage. It's just, it's art. It's true art. Yeah. You know, it was written from a place of inspiration.
I feel like, I like that type of history too, where it's so inspired, but it's also, they're not painting him as necessarily a true hero.
He's a dickhead.
He's such a, like, a jerk,
yeah.
You know, and he was involved in politics and, like, he was completely imperfect, but he was also so passionate and...
You are not necessarily rooting for him
yeah.
in the narrative. He's a dickhead and he's rude to Washington, who they're very careful to be like, Washington was the purest soul.
Yeah.
Hamilton had a terrible temper and an ego.
Yeah.
You know, you're not necessarily rooting for him the whole time. And I think that's, again, like, some of the art of creating a character like that is that you're... All that Lynn did with that was demonstrate Hamilton's accomplishments. It's not that you are devastated when he dies. I cried harder at four other points
in
the
totally.
Play.
Oh, totally.
Totally. How interesting is that? It's called Hamilton. The play is called Hamilton, yeah. And I didn't necessarily cry when he dies.
Do you think part of it is that us as adults now, we look back to history as it was being taught when we were growing up, and it was, I mean, there's one path of history. It's the history that's in your history book, and that's it, and that's what's written down.
Now I'm a villain in your history.
but seriously, now, like, you can add this nuance to what we learned as kids, and it almost it's inspires this new view of history.
Can I be honest with you?
Yes.
I don't remember learning anything about Hamilton in history classes.
Yeah, he wasn't a highlight character in history classes, I don't think.
Who shot Alexander Hamilton in the famous duel?
But you only know that because...
It's a milk commercial!
Exactly, same.
Emma!
Emma! What? Emma! Hold on, I guess I'm up. No!
That guy was in That Thing You Do. We came here to meet girls and dance! I call him Steve Buscemi Jr. because he kind of looks like him, right? He totally does.
He totally does.
Yeah.
He just has, like, googly eyes.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that's the look.
Remember?
That is literally the only information that I knew about Hamilton.
Yeah. That, I'm telling you, that was, like, our generation, though. I don't think we studied Alexander Hamilton that, but I mean...
I'd like to thank the Dairy Farmers Association for the masterwork that is Hamilton.
Mm.
And now, to close this out, Tom is going to sing Stars. Do you want some accompany music?
Is that you singing also?
No, it's me pretending like I'm a piano.
Sure.
Okay. I didn't think you were going to say yes.
Yeah, I don't even know what...
Can you sing it a cappella, or do you want me to play
something? I mean, something? I haven't tried to sing it in so long.
Other than when other you were in the shower yesterday?
By myself all the time. It's funny because I don't know a ton of the words.
So like, did I already say this? They go to... I'm in London by myself, sitting in the second to last row of the theater. The guy goes to sing Stars. I don't know what came over me. I cried... The entire song. Just tears streaming down my face. It was...
To Stars? Stars is about, like, self-discovery, and it's really important. So I get that.
It was just this idea that he needs so badly for things to fit the frame that he has created for himself in the world. And he says, Lord, let me find him that I may see him safe behind bars. And that's the second, but you don't even know that that's a connected sentence
yeah.
because of the way that it's sung. And that's I didn't even crazy. Really hear it until I heard the Leslie Odom Jr. version. And he sings it, Lord, let me find him, that I may see him. And I'm thinking him is God.
Yeah.
Safe behind bars.
Well, there's two layers to that, too, though, is he's saying safe behind bars.
And I always thought he was saying, Lord, let me seek him.
Yeah.
God.
Right, yeah. That's crazy.
Do you want... Would you feel less self-conscious if I put some music under it? I can pull YouTube up.
No, not really. I mean, I think... What?
Original London cast lyrics?
Probably. Yeah, there you go.
Okay, and then we're going to do YouTube and see if there's a track, a backing track.
And it's funny because I don't think I know how to sing it without the words being sung louder behind me.
Well, I can get you... Ooh! Let's see how this guy sounds. Alright, tell me how this sounds.
Out in the darkness, a fugitive running, fallen from grace. God be my witness, I never shall yield till we come face to face. Till we come face to face. He knows his way in the dark, but mine is the way of the Lord. Those who follow the path of the righteous shall have their reward. And if they fall as Lucifer fell, the flame, the sword. Stars in your multitude, scarce to be counted, filling the darkness with order and light. You are the sentinels, silent and sure, keeping watch in the night. Keeping watch in the night. You know your place in the sky. You hold your course and your aim. And each in your season returns and returns and is always the same. And if you fall as Lucifer fell, you fall in flames. And so it must be, and so it has written on the doorways to paradise that those who falter and those who fall must pay the price. Lord, let me find him. That I may see him safe behind bars.
Oh, you went high on that one.
I will never rest. I don't think I've sung this part. Yeah. Wow.
That was dramatic.
Sorry, I don't know that part.
And that's it for episode 15. Thanks for joining us for Garage Artois. Tune in next week for more fun with Courtney and Marie.